Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. So a Nobel Peace Prize winner, a Buddhist monk, and a Boy Scout are on a small plane. There are engine problems. The engine cuts out. And the pilot comes back and says, there are four of us and there are only three parachutes. I just got my pilot's license. I'm young. I have a long life to live. And he grabs a parachute and he jumps out the door. The Nobel Peace Prize winner says, I am the smartest man in the world. I have so much to give to this world, and it's too early for me to die. So he grabs a parachute, jumps out the door. The old monk looks at the Boy Scout and says, I've lived a long life. I have been blessed in this life. You're young and vital. It's really important that you take the final parachute and jump. And the boy says, that's okay, sir. We'll both be okay. Because the smartest man in the world just jumped out the door with my day pack. So one of the morals of that story is that smart does not mean wise. And that's the topic of this talk on wisdom or insight. This is the fourth of the 10 perfections, these qualities you can cultivate that help to bring you more fully alive. So wisdom or insight is sometimes described as discriminating knowledge. It's kind of an intuitive apprehension of what is true or real. So I'd like to talk tonight about how cultivating wisdom is perhaps the most important thing that you can do in this life. And to talk a little bit about what gets in the way of wisdom. A little bit about the anatomy of an insight. This practice is sometimes called insight meditation. So what's the anatomy of an insight? How do we actually cultivate insight and wisdom? And fourth, to talk a little bit about the balance of two fundamental elements of wisdom and compassion and how they work together. So a number of years ago, gosh, probably maybe 10 or 15 years ago, when I was out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with a friend, I met this amazing fellow by the name of Eric Kassir, and spent a number of days hanging out with him at this place that he built outside of Santa Fe, and got to know him a little bit over a number of days. And he had just one of the most interesting people I'd ever met. He was born in Germany to kind of a wealthy Jewish family. And his uncle was kind of a well-known philosopher, Ernst Kassir. And Einstein used to come to their house to play chess with his uncle. And when Eric was in school, he wrote something for one of his essays that was against the government and what was happening at that time in the early formation of Nazi Germany. And he was taken aside by one of his teachers and said, it would be a really good idea if you want to live, to leave. So he, I think he was maybe 17, and he just left and went to Canada and became a plumber. And over a number of years, he became head of the Plumbers Union in Canada, and then he moved to California, and then he built up the fourth largest used car dealership in California. Then he got tired of that. Then he was really interested in building, so he learned how to build buildings, and he built these, you know, big high-rise office buildings. And then he went to Esalen Institute in California, and he discovered, like, energy, like healing energy. And suddenly that became his life work, of traveling around and teaching people how to use healing energy. So it was a fascinating to spend time with someone who had lived like three or four lifetimes in one life, and who had been through lots of tragedy, but also tremendous insight into life, just tremendous wisdom. And it was through meeting him that I began to recognize that, from what I can tell, some of the most wise people I've met have gone through suffering. They've experienced suffering. They've experienced loss. But somehow that loss has just added to the presence of their character. So it's an interesting reflection. Who would you say are the wisest people that you've encountered in your life? When you reflect and do a little inventory, you know, who are the people in your life that have struck you as being wise? There seems to be some relationship between the relationship to suffering, the wisdom that can come out of suffering, certainly not necessarily, but also a quality of compassion, that sort of wisdom and compassion together. You could say that wisdom is the capacity to see what's true. And through this lens of Buddhist psychology, it's really best summed up as seeing into the three characteristics of reality. Of course, as the Buddha offered this teaching, he would say, don't believe a word of what I'm telling you. You know, you have to verify this. But if you look closely, you'll see that everything conditioned is going to change. Everything that's born out of causes and conditions is subject to change. And then you'll see into the second quality, the second characteristic of reality, that has to do with your relationship to what is changing. If you are resisting change, you will experience stress and suffering. If you're wanting something to change and it isn't, to the degree you're holding on to that, you will feel stress and suffering. And the third characteristic of reality is seeing into the nature of the self. That when you look at who and what you are, you could say that who and what you are is the product of causes and conditions. You had a mother and a father, this biological body which will change. You have all of your opinions and your stories and memories. Those are subject to change. But perhaps there's something unconditioned in who you are that is not subject to change. Something to reflect on. I think we all touch into that from time to time, some sense of a timeless presence. When you think about who you were looking at yourself in the mirror when you were six, and who you are now looking at yourself in the mirror, that one who's looking hasn't changed. The body has. So that's really what this journey is all about, this human journey or this spiritual journey. It's about cultivating wisdom to see what's really true. And part of how wisdom seems to work is that when you really get that everything is changing, it increases your capacity to savor and embrace and celebrate what's here. And so we're all drawn to some degree to find out what's real in our lives. You wouldn't be here tonight unless you were coerced or were just driving by and saw the lights on. We've talked a little bit about how setting off on this journey is really, it's the hero's journey. Each of us is in our own journey to discover our true nature. And along the way, there are obstacles. So with this look at the 10 perfections, these are like the 10 qualities that if you polish these qualities, it's like facets of a diamond. The first we explored was generosity, cultivating a quality of a generous heart, to give of yourself freely. The second is to look closely at your behavior. Is your behavior in alignment with what you most want? And it's very interesting to see the progression that if you focus on generosity, you will find yourself ultimately not only more generous to others, but more generous to yourself. And that can immediately affect how you live in the world, the desire to do no harm, the desire to be a contribution, to be a giver rather than a taker. The third of the 10 perfections is about renunciation, which is about letting go of what you don't need in this life. Letting go of everything that's distracting you from your purpose. And when you let go of what's distracting you, inevitably that will lead to wisdom. If you're not distracted, you'll be able to see more clearly. When you have that glass of muddy water and you put it on the countertop, it begins to settle. And that's that quality of clear seeing that wisdom speaks of. So just as when you want to be more present and you meditate, you notice how you're not present. When you want to be more compassionate and you really pay attention, you'll notice how stingy you are, how petty you are. And in that same way, when you explore what it means to be wise, you'll notice everything that's between you and feeling wise. So then the question is, well, what gets in the way of being wise? And fortunately, there is a really wonderful resource, an incredible compendium that gives us insights into this whole thing of what it means to not be wise. You may be familiar with them. They're called the Darwin Awards. If you're not familiar with these, they're hilarious and tragic at the same time. And the Darwin Awards are basically a record of people who have successfully removed themselves from the gene pool. Or someone once described it as it's chlorinating the gene pool. So I'll share with you just a few of these. There's one fellow, the Niagara Falls jet ski jumper. In 1995, a particularly daring daredevil named Robert decided to attempt something no one had ever done before, riding his jet ski off Niagara Falls. Now, that might sound completely stupid, but Robert had done some planning. He'd fitted his jet ski with a rocket booster and was carrying a parachute. The idea was to fire the booster as he hit the falls, opening the parachute at the apex of his flight and drifting down to safety in the water below. Unfortunately, Robert had failed to factor in one crucial element, the fact that water makes things wet. As he hurtled toward the falls and pressed the button, his utterly soaked rocket booster failed to ignite. Plummeting off the edge, he tried his parachute, but it wasn't waterproof either and failed to deploy. That is the opposite of wisdom right there. And you may know this story. It was just a cute one. This is 1982. Frustrated in his dream of becoming an Air Force pilot, a Southern California truck driver gets himself airborne anyway with the help of a lawn chair and 42 helium-filled weather balloons. Airborne, that is, at 16,000 feet in elevation. Poor Airsight put the kibosh on Larry Walters' Top Gun dreams, but he was determined to fly. You'd think he'd just go out and get himself a commercial pilot's license, but no, he had this idea of flying using unused balloons. So opportunity finally knocked in 82 when he and his girlfriend purchased 42 8-foot weather balloons and several tanks of helium. From there, the idea was simplicity itself. Attaching a garden variety Sears aluminum lawn chair to the balloons, strap on some water jugs for ballast, take along a pellet pistol to shoot out the balloons to control the descent, pack a parachute, carry a CB radio, and maybe with luck, sail across the desert to the Rocky Mountains. Oh, and take along some beer and sandwiches for the ride. So the craft was cut loose from its moorings on July 2nd. With him securely strapped into his patio chair, he ascended rapidly, much more rapidly than he anticipated, and rose above San Pedro. He said he'd intended to fly only about 30 feet or so before leveling off, while munching sandwiches and pounding a few Miller Lights. Instead, he shot skyward at the rate of about 1,000 feet per minute and didn't level off until he'd reached 16,000 feet. He was way up high, and he was scared and probably not hungry anymore. But now he had another, more immediate problem. He was drifting to the flight path of incoming planes to Los Angeles International Airport. A clearly worried Walters used his CB radio to transmit a Mayday call, which was picked by operators on the ground, and he made contact with them through the flight. Despite his precarious situation, after the initial shock wore off, Walters was a picture of calm. He told those now monitoring him that he knew he was in trouble one way or another. Either he'd plunge to his death, get sucked into a jet engine, or get busted when he landed. He wasn't run down by a commercial airliner. Instead, he continued drifting, and he was spotted by pilots of at least two inbound LAX flights, including a TWA captain who radioed that he was passing a man in a lawn chair at 16,000 feet who was holding onto a pistol in his hand. Eventually, screwing up his courage, Walter shot out several balloons. He began a slow descent, but dropped the pistol before he could shoot at any more. 90 minutes after liftoff, he was safely back on terra firma, but not until the tethers hanging from his balloons fouled some power lines, knocking out electricity in a Long Beach neighborhood. The chair was dangling about 5 feet off the ground when he hopped down to a waiting reception committee from the LAPD. So there's wisdom and then there's not wisdom. So when you reflect on what gets in the way of wisdom, if you think about the people in your life who you would put in that category of not wise, they perhaps have certain characteristics as well. So when we think of the awareness of impermanence, of your relationship to impermanence, and that there is this unconditioned self at the core of who you are, you could say that those who are not wise forget impermanence, that they believe that what is here is real, that they are very attached to their suffering, and they're very attached to themselves as a separate being. Another way to look at this, of what gets in the way of wisdom, is referred in some traditions as the three poisons. These are three qualities that will absolutely obscure your capacity to tap into wisdom. And they are greed, hatred, and delusion. That when you are caught in greed and wanting, we're blinded by our wanting sometimes. We are blinded by our hatred and by our aversion. And we're blinded by delusion. Delusion or confusion is believing something's true that isn't, or believing something isn't true that is. And so, of course, we see this flow of greed, hatred, and delusion permeating our culture, permeating our human experience, and when you honestly reflect, they play out in our lives as well. So this is the challenge then, to see clearly, to notice where you get caught by unfulfilled craving, by that unwholesome aversion or hatred, and to really see where you're deluded in life. There's a prayer that I shared in YLM recently that I always refer to this as sort of like the most awful prayer from yoga philosophy. And it goes like this: Lord, burn what can be burned, drown what can be drowned, and cut what can be cut. For I want to know what it is that cannot be burned, cannot be drowned, and cannot be cut. And while there's a brutality to that, there's something that's very close to, I think, our deepest intention. And so when you sign up for this path of being awake and cultivating wisdom, of course, you get to see everywhere you're identified, everywhere you're caught. And it's not necessarily an easy ride. This path is not a walk in the park. A reading from Hafez. Love wants to reach out and manhandle us, break all our teacup talk of God. If you had the courage and could give the beloved his choice, some nights he would just drag you around the room by your hair, ripping from your grip all those toys in the world that bring you no joy. Love sometimes gets tired of speaking sweetly and wants to rip to shreds all your erroneous notions of truth that make you fight within yourself, dear one, and with others, causing the world to weep on too many fine days. God wants to manhandle us, lock us inside a tiny room with himself, and practice his dropkick. The beloved sometimes wants to do us a great favor, hold us upside down and shake the nonsense out. But when we hear he's such in a playful, drunken mood, most everyone I know quickly packs their bags and hightails it out of town. So it's always a question of how much do you really want to see clearly? What are you willing to give up in order to see more clearly? I'm perpetually inspired by those who elect to engage in practice because it requires courage. There's one level of meditation which I refer to in my own life, what I call my maintenance meditation. It's a certain amount of time every day when I pause and close my eyes. It helps me to be refreshed, and I generally have my nostrils above the waterline at the end of the day if I do that maintenance level practice. But if you do a little more practice, it kind of brings you into a kind of what I call the transformational level of practice, where suddenly you become more aware of your unhappiness. You become more aware of the unfulfilled longing. You become more aware of the undigested grief. And that is a natural byproduct of this practice as well. And it requires a particular formula to stay with it. As one of my teachers said, most people stop practicing precisely because it's working. And the classic teaching is to engage in some discipline, knowing there are times when the last thing in the world you're going to want to do is to close your eyes, cultivate non-judging presence and pay attention to what's there, because it may not be pretty. The second thing is to find times of intensive retreat, times when you can really drop deep, step away from the distractions of your world. And the third is to find like-minded people, people who kind of understand how this works. I've always joked about one of the things I loved about living in an ashram for so long, and one of the things I so enjoy about engaging with people who are actively engaged in their practice, is that you can go to another person, they can say, "How are you doing?" And you can say, "You know, I'm just feeling really shaky and insecure these days, and I'm aware of kind of this low-grade anxiety in the background all the time." And the other person will say, "That's great. Wow. How cool." You don't get that anywhere else. Because there's an understanding that this is a practice of awakening. It's a practice of recognizing what's below the line of awareness. So the question then is, how do you cultivate insight? How do you live your life in a way where you can cultivate wisdom? How do I see more clearly through the veil of my own ignorance? I'm doing a 5-day retreat this summer, which I do annually at Kripalu Center. It's called The Still Small Voice Within, and it's about developing intuition, about the relationship between meditation, like a non-judging awareness, and sort of the technologies of intuition, kind of how to see clearly. And one of the interesting things about intuition is that you can't make it happen. All you can do is create the most optimal space you can for your intuition to flow freely. And it's that same way with cultivating an insight. You can't make it happen, but you can cultivate an optimal shift, the optimal conditions for a shift. As Einstein said, no problem was ever solved in the same consciousness that created it. So if you're caught, if you're in a rut, if you're stuck, you have to somehow shift your consciousness to be able to view it from another elevation. Oftentimes, when there is some form of an insight, there is sometimes a shift in a point of view. For example, if you're in conflict with another person, that when you can get out of your story and do a role reversal and really, really get the other person's experience, sometimes that can lead to a powerful insight. Because you've shifted your identity from a tightly held self to this capacity to role reverse, opening up the empathy channel. And when you can get another person's experience, it can be quite powerful. So I thought I might share just a little short little meditation. This is a kind of a classic meditation that is sort of designed to help you explore this shift in consciousness. So for this meditation, you'll want to reflect on some problematic situation you might have, some conflict you might have with another person. And if you can't think of one, just make one up. So this might be just some situation where you feel dissatisfied or there is some sense of separation. So as you close the eyes and feel the breath, you might take a little time to go through the files and think about a situation where you feel some conflict. And you might imagine yourself in a room with this person and imagine the conflict very present. If you're visual, you might find it helpful to create kind of a moving image, a picture like a little videotape, or you might see it as a still image. You might turn up the colors or the contrast a little bit. That might make it a little bit more alive for you. You might find it helpful to tune into the auditory channel. Are there words or a tone of voice or other sounds that you associate with this relationship? And then you might take a moment to begin to sense what it feels like inside. What does it feel like inside to be in conflict with this person? And you might even sense, what is this like at its worst, at its most chronic? Can you identify where you feel that inside? And what is the behavior that comes through you when you are this upset? And again, you might intensify it or exaggerate a little bit. And imagine this interaction, and then imagine it as a freeze frame. And now imagine yourself floating up to the ceiling, looking down on yourself and this other person. And you might imagine here at the ceiling that you're encountering a very wise being. It might be the Buddha, it might be Christ, it might be some wise ancestor. And imagine as you acknowledge this wise being that you are going to stay on the ceiling, and this wise being for just a few minutes is going to descend down and step into your body and will speak with your voice and your gestures. And as you watch, what does this wise being express? And now imagine this being coming back up to join you at the top of the ceiling. Maybe offering you a word or two of guidance or counsel. And then allow this to fall away. Again, to feel the breath. And then as you're ready, you can deepen the breath, or you can remain with your eyes closed. So I hope in some way that might have been helpful. It can be a helpful way to sort of cultivate that shift in identity. When we explore what it's like to cultivate insight or wisdom, it's very helpful to recognize that there's a function of the linear rational mind that serves you beautifully. It's the capacity of your mind to judge and to compare and to figure things out. And I would guess most of us make our living by judging, comparing, and figuring things out. But I've also noticed that when my intuition is alive, when I'm kind of aware of the mystery, or I'm in any moment of deep intimacy or connection to presence or whatever you might call it, there are three things that are not happening. I'm not comparing, I'm not judging, and I'm not trying to figure anything out. So opening to intuition has this quality of opening into that space, sort of that vulnerable space of presence. Oftentimes what happens in meditation practice is you're in the linear rational mind. The more you bring your attention back to the body and you rest in the here and now, you have these moments where judging, comparing, trying to figure things out are suspended, maybe for just a few milliseconds. But when you come back to the here and now, back into the present moment and suspend the comparing, judging, comparing mind, you're opening up this field. And Deepak Chopra calls it the field of infinite possibility. I always love that. But it's in that field where there can be a consciousness shift. Sometimes it's just simply a sense of, wow, I'm here. I'm actually feeling my breath as I breathe. I'm actually just feeling the sound vibrations as they're happening. There's just that sense of who you are as that non-judging witness, that non-judging presence. Those moments are infinitely healing. And sometimes, in those moments where there's no comparing, judging, trying to figure anything out, there will arise in that shift in consciousness a new thought, an insight, some new perspective, something you hadn't thought about before because you've shifted your consciousness. So the practice, that willingness to go into that undefended place of presence is incredibly ripe. There are other things that are very, very helpful. And one is to be around other people, as I'd mentioned, who are really wanting to cultivate wisdom and insight in their lives. Being around them is tremendously helpful. Being around others who are willing to reflect back to you how you're showing up is really, really helpful. Being around a mentor or a teacher can be very helpful. I remember in my writing classes of sending in a paper I thought was really good and getting it back absolutely shredded. That sense of just devastation, but then looking at the feedback and really seeing what I had missed and what I could learn. One of the most powerful ways to cultivate learning is to create a feedback loop where you're actually getting feedback as to how you're showing up. It's infinitely valuable. So as you cultivate wisdom, this capacity to see clearly, there's something that comes right along with it. If you look simply through the lens of wisdom, it's like just one bird trying to fly with one wing. You can see clearly, but seeing clearly is missing something. That's the other wing, and that's the wing of compassion. It's one thing to see clearly. It's another to be able to hold it with some compassion. I have a killer story and not enough time, so I'm going to share it next time. But there's something about when you look through the lens of wisdom, you see deeply into the nature of karma, action and reaction. When you have a hard winter, there are going to be fewer rabbits in the spring. Looking just through wisdom can be cold, because you can look through simply through the lens of action-reaction. If someone's suffering, well, they must have done something to create that suffering. If you look only through the lens of compassion, that can lead to codependence. And there's a beautiful story someone told of watching a butterfly in the chrysalis beginning to kind of break out of the chrysalis. And this butterfly was working really, really hard. And this person was just completely absorbed into watching this butterfly begin to emerge. And so he thought he'd help it. So he peeled back the chrysalis a little bit. And to his horror, he saw that the butterfly had one wing that hadn't fully developed. And he realized, to his horror, that the butterfly needed that all of the challenge of breaking out of that chrysalis to become a fully developed butterfly. So in that same way, we need to cultivate wisdom to see clearly, to see suffering as it is, but also to cultivate compassion and to find that delicate balance where you can hold someone you love with great compassion and to see clearly the lessons that they are learning and that they need to learn in their lives. That's part of that exquisite balance. So I'd like to close with a little reading which speaks to this of what can open inside as you cultivate wisdom. As you reflect on all that's changing in your life, you might let these words just pass through. You will lose everything. Your money, your power, your fame, your success, perhaps even your memories. Your looks will go. Loved ones will die. Your body will fall apart. Everything that seems permanent is impermanent and will be smashed. Experience will gradually, or not so gradually, strip away everything that it can strip away. Waking up means facing this reality with open eyes and no longer turning away. But right now, we stand on sacred and holy ground. For that which will be lost has not yet been lost. And realizing this is the key to unspeakable joy. Whoever or whatever it is in your life right now that has not yet been taken away from you. This may sound trivial, obvious, like nothing, but really it is the key to everything. The why and how and wherefore of existence. Impermanence has already rendered everything and everyone around you so deeply holy and significant and worthy of your heartbreaking gratitude. Loss has already transfigured your life into an altar. And deepening the breath. And when you're ready, you can let your eyes open. Thank you so much for your kind attention. It's kind of a heavy ending. Whew. I was really feeling it. A few quick announcements before we go. And Ben, do you have a ride? Yes, good. There is a very cool discussion group, a book discussion group. If you'd like to join, it's a great way to connect with like-minded folks. Next week, there is no class. It's Memorial Day. Remember, there's great yoga happening before class if you want to join in. It's a really, really wonderful thing. And there's a longer sit. If you'd like to come and sit for an hour rather than just half an hour, there's a group that meets downstairs. And you can check the newsletter for more information on that. And there is a discussion group, very cool collection, that's going to meet over here if you'd like to stick around. Again, it's just a great way to connect with like-minded folks to share a little bit about your practice that's happening. And I believe there are tea and cookies, thanks to our wonderful tea and cookie people. And I also want to mention something very, very cool. This is called the transmissions ceremony. It's tomorrow night. It's this wonderful blend of music and a guided experience from Reverend Aaron here at the church. So if you're really wanting to come and kind of join into a really cool healing vibe, it's really worth checking out. So be sure to grab a flyer if you're interested and take part. They put a lot into creating this this healing energy space. So. Do keep that in mind. You can sign up in the back if you're not on the mailing list and want to be. And as always, thank you for your support that keeps this thing rolling. Happy trails, happy cookie. I'll see you in a few weeks.